For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. The decade of the 1930s will ever be remembered as hard times in America and much of the rest of the world. It was the time of the Great Depression, after the collapse of the stock market, and Wall Street was littered with the shards of broken economic dreams. The Roosevelt administration was intent on recovery that included putting color and romance back into the cultural gray zone dominated by despair. While the Civilian Conservation Corps built fire lookout towers and check dams and planted trees and riprapped arroyos, the New Deal federal artist projects funded artists, writers, photographers, and musicians to capture the complex cultural phase of America and provide art for everyone. New Mexico, while ever on the low end of the economic totem pole, remains one of the richest multicultural regions in the United States. Eliseo Rodriguez, a native Hispano, was born in 1915 in Santa Fe, where as a child he herded goats, tickled trout in the Santa Fe River, and tended the cornfield. He came of age during the Great Depression, where he revealed himself as an artist who has since had an enormous impact on the Hispanic art movement in America.
I met Eleanor Bedell. She was such a wonderful person. She said, "I'm very well acquainted with the Vernon Hunter, who is the state director of the art project, which is the WPA. He's seen some of your work. You might have a chance to get connected." Then she gave me a piece of paper. And there at the corner of Galisteo, there was a two-story building there. It's still there. There was a lot of people going upstairs, waiting to go talk to this guy, Vernon Hunter. "Oh my gosh," I said to myself, "it's going to take a long time before I can get to talk to this guy." And it so happened that one fellow who used to deliver telegrams was a friend of mine, Carrillo was his name, from La Cienega, and he said, "Well, hi, how you doing?" And we started talking, and he said, "Well, I have to deliver this telegram right away to Mr. Vernon Hunter." I said, "Why don't you let me deliver it? I'll do the same." And he said, "Sure, why not?" So I just went, I moved people to one side, telegram from Mr. Hunter, and I went into his office, and I told him the whole story, see. And he was very much impressed how I could have gotten in to talk to him and be proud to other people. And so he said, "I'll tell you what you do." He said, "I've seen your work, and I'm very much impressed on what you're doing. There's a lot of polishing to do, but we can work that out. But what you have to do is go to the courthouse and talk to the ladies there to see if you can get into the welfare program so that you can be qualified." I took off. I went to the courthouse. They were kind of mean. "Well, at your age, you're getting married. You know what you're getting into." And I said, "Yes, I know. I have my wife now, and I'm trying to find a job to keep her going." That was in 1935, 36. So finally, I did get the slip of paper, and they qualified me to be in the welfare department. From there on, I went over to and showed Mr. Vernon Hunter the paper, and I started working as a painter. And he says, "You're going to get your materials, you're going to get your brushes, and see what you can do, can get started tomorrow." And I said, "I'm ready to start right now." And so I started working and doing landscape and stuff like that. But that was the advantage and the beauty of the whole WPA. People don't realize that. But they gave you a chance to experiment with different deals, you see.
Kathy Flynn is the executive director of the National New Deal Preservation Association and an authority on the history of the New Deal art projects.
The art project in New Mexico was run by Russell Vernon Hunter. He was, according to his wife, the only federal art project person that stayed throughout the entire time. The federal art project and the others fell under the WPA. And the WPA stood for the Works Progress Administration for 35 to 39. The second go-round was 1939 to 42. Then it was called the Works Projects Administration. And within that, of course, you had the guys that were working and leaning on the shovels, which they couldn't have possibly leaned in that much considering all that got done. But you then also had the Federal Writers Project, the Music Project, the Art Project, the Theater Project, all of these things to hire these people also. Nearly everybody got on the Federal Art Project or Music or whatever because everybody was starving or had a family to feed. You were either given a specific thing to do or you were given canvases and paints and this sort of thing and told to go paint. You had a supervisor, namely Gustav Baumann. What I have found so far is that we had about 166 artists working in the project, the Federal Art Project here in New Mexico. And that was broken down like 29 women, 29 or so Native Americans. And there was actually a separate Indian project. And John Collier ran that whole Indian project. We have found 60 murals or mural-sized paintings in New Mexico, and 657 paintings, 10 sculptures, 43 pieces of Patrocinio Barella's work, and then there was crafts out the Kazakh. The Hispanics really kind of got the short shift in the sense that bureaucratically, most of the Hispanic artists were just referred to as assistants to whoever they were working with. So for a long time, we didn't know who all those people were. And fortunately, Tay Mariana Nunn elected to find that out as a part of a doctoral program in which she completed, and she found, I think, most all of the Hispanic artists.
Tay Mariana Nunn is the Director for Visual Arts and Chief Curator for the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque. Her book, Sin Nombre, portrays Hispana and Hispano artists of New Mexico of the 1930s.
One of the reasons I got interested in Hispano artists of the 30s and the 40s was I figured that because of language and culture, there had to have been a connection between New Mexico and Mexico in the 30s and the 40s with that flourishing of Mexican art and how Mexican art was becoming so popular with the muralists, with Diego Rivera and Orozco and Siqueiros and Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo here in the 30s. There's a book called The Enormous Vogue of Things Mexican, where inter-American relations and Pan-American relations were all focused on Mexico and, you know. But I kept on wondering because of the artist colonies in Taos and Santa Fe and the artistic legacy in New Mexico, if there was any connection, if any of the artists, Hispano artists, had gone down to Mexico or if any of them had come up here and they just hadn't been recorded. I started looking around for those names and, you know, there were very few Hispano names recorded with the exception of the WPA works and the Writers Project. There are very few Hispano artists recorded in New Mexico. So that sort of became my quest. The Spanish colonial artistic legacy in New Mexico. And I'll just talk about Hispano. I won't talk about Native American art because that's not my area of expertise. But the same sort of thing happens there too at the same time period. Spanish colonial artistic legacy, in many ways, the knowledge of it or the recording of it for posterity's sake changed when the railroads came in. It's always easy to blame and say, oh, the Hispano population of northern New Mexico and the rest of New Mexico wanted the new things. They wanted the new plaster statues and the mass-produced prints. There's a whole lot of reasons for that. And when you go back and talk about the importance of things, it was just an image. It wasn't necessarily that people didn't appreciate the handmade image, but this was a new image or perhaps a more affordable image. And so that time period with new furniture techniques and Sears catalog and all those sorts of things sort of change the dynamic and the importance of New Mexican arts. And one of the things that happens too is that many of those New Mexican arts early on before the turn of the century were utilitarian. So there's furniture, and there's weaving, and there's santos, and there's tin nichos, or tin mirrors, or tin fixtures, and they were all utilitarian, so that wasn't something that people normally considered as art. It was something you used every day. So with people like E. Boyd and Frank Applegate, and Mary Austin and Anglo artists and writers who come from other places and see this vernacular art form that sort of permeated and has really deep-seated roots and has permeated architecture and all sorts of aspects of New Mexico. That idea and the way they have of looking at art from back east or the Midwest is different. Have to give a lot of people credit. There's a lot of people say, oh, it was the Anglo people who did this, blah, 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 blah. But it was a group of Anglo intelligentsia writers and painters and artists who recognized the importance of the native Spanish art forms.
Will Schuster, and one of the great stories about him was that he's writing a letter to John Sloan saying, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, I've told the utility companies they'll just have to cut it off because I can't pay my utilities. The only place I can get credit is at Connie's grocery store over there on College Street. And he says, you know, I don't know what we're going to do. And then he writes him a few weeks later and says, can you believe it? The federal government is going to pay me to paint. And I have offered them three opportunities that I would do. One would be to redesign the federal currency. Second one was to paint portraits of all the Indian war chiefs in the nation. And the third one is to paint the stalactites and stalagmites in Carlsbad Caverns, because I've been down there in a bucket and I've seen that. And that's what they let him do. And then, of course, he did the frescoes in the courtyard at the Museum of Fine Arts. Fremont Ellis, Bill Lumpkins, most people don't know that Bill was on, William Penhallow Henderson. There are six magnificent mural-sized paintings. They are, you know, on canvas, glued to the wall, next to the post office in the federal courthouse. Raymond Johnson was also one. The Federal Art Project nationwide was basically to depict American realism, and it was the beginning of the American art as we know it today. In New Mexico, we painted what we looked like back then. We painted ourselves how we lived, what we did, and we had the whole gamut. I mean, we had Emil Bistrom. I mean, Raymond Johnson's modern stuff, Isla McAfee's horses and deers, and Olive Rush's light, lovely frescoes. And I've heard more than one artist say that it was the first time Joe Blow on the street saw fine art. The only art they'd ever seen before was on calendars. And they also saw artists working, like in the post offices or the courthouses. The thing they thought that, you know, all artists were weirdos. They were strange. And they discovered they weren't. They sat down and talked with them and watched them work and realized that they were just like them and they were hungry just the same. So we had John Jellicoe, Peter Hurd, Odin Hullenkramer from Santa Fe, Joseph Fleck, Louis Ewing. Louis Ewing had an assistant, namely Eliseo Rodriguez. He and his assistant figured out a way to do serigraphs and silk screening.
Mark Ewing is the son of the late celebrated artist Louis Ewing. He recounts some of the shaping projects in his father's career.
The WPA surfaced, and he was contacted by Vernon Hunter, who was the director for New Mexico, I believe. He had a packet of information that he received from Washington on silkscreen. And this information, I guess, was kind of sketchy, but it was information about the old process of silk screening. So it was kind of dumped in my dad's lap, and he was challenged to see what he could do with the subject and what kind of creative things could be done with silk screening. So he dove into this project and really kind of learned all on his own. He had a good background, but this was new to him, but he took this information and he really had to get in there and struggle to learn it. For example, and maybe you spoke to Eliseo about this, they had trouble with a squeegee, which was a tool used to spread the paint over the screen. And they tried a rubber tire, and the paint would melt it. And, you know, they just had all of these problems. And I guess my dad finally contacted some people who worked with rubber materials and so forth, and they came up with a product that would not dissolve with the paint. So they mastered that. I guess he mentioned that Eliseo had helped him with his first print. He was several years younger. He must have been, 7, 8 years younger than my dad.
They asked me if I would be interested in working with Louis Ewing, who was going to start working on silkscreen prints. I said, yes, I'd love to do that. So I went and met Louis Ewing living on Canyon Road. And we got together and we started working, and we started doing all the silk screens. We did the posters for the Anthropology Museum, and it was a pretty good job.
Joseph Bakos, Fremont Ellis, Walter Murek, Willard Nash, and Will Schuster, the group that would later be known as the Cinco Pintores. The idea of the Cinco Pintores was that they, you know, had kind of a salon and they hung out together on Canyon Road and they had parties and they talked art and they created art. And artists and writers and journalists who described the Cinco Pintores and elevated the Cinco Pintores to their status left out the fact that there were a whole lot of other people in that group. And one of the people who painted alongside them and who went to the same parties and who went to the same dances and played off their creativity and was a member of that group at that time, that creative group in Santa Fe, was Eliseo Rodriguez. And I felt it very necessary to help elevate his status and show that there was a whole other, I mean, according to Eliseo anyway, he helped Will Schuster create Zozobra. But that's completely left out of the stories. And I think it depends on who's writing those accounts and who's writing those art history books and how they categorize different people and different ethnicities as artists.
We had a wonderful time. We got to meet most everybody. Yeah.
You did, yeah.
Starting with down on Canyon Road with Hal West and Jim Morris and Chuck Barrow and Holland Kramer. We used to go over to Alfred Morang's place on a weekend, every Saturday?
Every Saturday, yes.
And Paula would cook, like, for example, chile con frijoles and tortilla, and then we go to this party where Alfred would be playing the violin. He always loved to play the violin, and very good. And Dorothy, that was Alfred Morant's wife, she played the piano.
Yeah.
And other people were talking about art and designing and everybody, little groups, you see.
I am very devoted to Eliseo Rodriguez. I remember the first time I interviewed Eliseo Rodriguez and Paula Rodriguez in their house in Santa Fe. The pictures started coming out and the old sketchbook started coming out. It was really great. I was able to run a whole bunch of archival photos that I had found at the Archives of American Art in Washington, D.C., and I knew that they were by New Mexican artists, but of course nobody had bothered to record the artists' names. And so even though I knew they weren't things by Eliseo, I showed him the photos. And he was the one who was able to name off, well, that's by so-and-so, that's by so-and-so, that's by so-and-so, that's by me. I had known Eliseo as a straw applique artist, but what I hadn't realized is that he started off as a painter. This was a reverse painting on glass of a crucifixion in a tin frame by Ildeberto Delgado, who was another WPA artist. It was really a magical moment because I said, you did this? And it was a beautifully, finely done reverse painting on glass. And Eliseo told me about how reverse painting on glass was really, really hard. And it was a WPA piece. It was a Federal Art Project piece. And also how the hardest part of it was doing your name backwards. The painting was easy, but writing your name backwards was really, really hard. So he had some good laughs about that. And I asked him if he knew where the piece was. And he said he had no idea where the piece was. He hadn't seen it. But this was a piece that I could tell by the documentation in the National Archives had traveled all around the United States. And so I thought, I wonder where this is. And so one day I was in the Museum of New Mexico Central Registration Office, which was downtown, and I looked over my shoulder and there were some documents on top of a file cabinet. And it said, reverse painting on glass of crucifixion in tin frame, artist unknown. And I pulled the document out and it showed that it was in the Palace of the Governors. So that day we went over to the Palace of the Governors, and there in a dark corner was this piece of Eliseo's art. I called the museum photographer. I ran up to get Eliseo, and we have a picture of him holding the piece. And it was pretty amazing, and he cried because he hadn't seen it in so long, and it was one of his masterpieces. But what I had learned from all of that experience is that Eliseo isn't just known for doing straw applique, that he was a painter, as he says he was the first Spanish painter in the Santa Fe Art School. But his impact on contemporary Chicano and Latino and Hispano artists in New Mexico is huge because at that time of the Chicano movement and civil rights movements in the 60s, painters like Luis Tapia, Pola Lopez, and a number of other people, Eliseo was the only person they knew who had painted. I think Eliseo's role in the Federal Art Project and the WPA art is huge, but it goes further than that later on because of his impact on New Mexican arts. And people forget that because he was a painter first, he took the art of straw applique in a whole new way, because the art of straw applique before Eliseo was mostly geometric patterning. And because of Eliseo's painting talents, he paints in straw and he makes it narrative so that you can tell stories in the straw. So he totally transforms the art form. So his impact is big, huge.
Vernon Hunter.
Yeah.
At the time, he asked me, would I be interested in trying that straw business? He said, have you seen it? And I said, no, I haven't seen anything like that. And he said, well, it's supposed to be a little piece of straw. And he tried to explain everything to me. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, I'm going to try it. And he said, well, I'll tell you what you do. Try a little bit of that straw. Still keep on with your work. But this would be sort of on the side to see what you can do with it. I didn't know. I think about it. The first one that I was gluing on, instead of splitting in half, I put the whole deal, you see. But then when I work it out, the other half will come out, and then I look, and the one that was supposed to be the good one was flattened. One night I stayed all night just trying to figure it out, and it worked. It finally worked, and so I worked my first sort of a retablo, and that was the head of Christ. And I used different shades of the straw, and it looked like a regular mosaic. That man was so excited, and he thought that it was really something very special. And then I told Paula to, and she just kept on working all the time. She was getting to be better than that. She did very good.
The New Deal also funded photographers, musicians, and writers throughout the 1930s. Kathy Flynn gives us a sense of the importance of New Deal photography.
Photography, FSA, Farm Security Administration, something that Library of Congress has come out with. It's an exhibit called Bound for Glory, and I believe they also have a book out. But the interesting thing about that in relation to New Mexico is that the Bound for Glory exhibit is an example of how the Farm Security Administration photographers were given Kodacolor. Kodak would just come out with Kodacolor, and they wanted to try it out. So they gave the FSA photographers this film, and they would take a shot in black and white, and then they would take the same shot in color. And I've seen the show. There's probably 25 photographs in it, and I would say over half are New Mexico. The majority of the work that was done was up around Trompas and Truchas and then down in Pytown. And we have a number of people who were involved as photographers here in New Mexico. John Collier, Dorothea Lange. But I have to share a story about that probably not a whole lot of people know. One of our board members is a photographer, and for 25 years, he has been bringing college students, his graduate students, to northern New Mexico and taking those FSA photos and finding the people. He has taken those students and gone to the senior citizen centers and had breakfast there or lunch there every day, would sit down with the people, show them this old photo, and say, "Do you know who this was? And are they still alive today?" And he has then taken pictures of the people that were still alive. And then he's given them to the families. And the family said, "This man has given us our history." He showed one picture to somebody, and they said, "Oh, yeah, that's so-and-so. She's still alive." And he said, "Well, do you know how I could get hold of her?" And they said, "Well, she's sitting right over there eating her lunch." And he went over and put the picture down, and she passed out right in her food. His name is Cavalier Ketchum. A wealth of stuff was done in New Mexico in terms of the FSA.
Both Te Mariana Nunn and her mother Te Diana Rebolledo have scoured archives of photographs and also interviews gathered by writers as part of the New Deal Writers Project.
You know, what the Federal Writers Project did for New Mexico is really insert New Mexican culture and history into the greater U.S. culture and history. And one of the ways they did that was with the WPA Guide to New Mexico. Every state was supposed to do one of these. I don't know if every state ever finished them through the Writers Project. But this is really a Bible to not only early 20th century New Mexico, but now you can still follow the routes and the roads. And they produced it through the Writers Project. And it has road tours. It talks about the arts. It talks about the cities. It talks about folklore, religion, education, literature, architecture. So it explains it. So that's when you know that road culture has taken over, because here's this tour guide, you know, and it's probably not the first tour guide of New Mexico, but it was one of the important ones because it was produced with this national initiative so that everybody would have one. And so they became very popular so that whenever you visited a state on a road trip, you bought the guide. The basics for tourism and New Mexican history, the Writers Project was very big. On a more local level, but I would hope a national level also, the Writers Project not only had Anglo writers from outside the state writing, but they used a lot of New Mexican writers, and they used a lot of Nuevo Mexicano informants to get the stories from. And they recorded at a time when it was really necessary and could have been on the verge. We're always on the verge of losing folklore and culture, right? But at that time, it was sort of a national and international phenomenon to record everything, the folk arts, and to record history and culture. And so the New Mexico Writers Project records dichos and corridos, folk stories, local histories. And a reader now can go back and look at those and try to figure out where that story was written. They're so beautifully written that they describe buildings or camposantos or graveyards, towns, and you could take the short stories and go into the town and see if you could still find it. The writers were very important, and they were recognized on a national level also. I mean, Elba C. de Vaca from Las Vegas and Lauren Brown and Aurora Lucero White, Reyes Martinez, who not only collected Santos and New Mexican arts, but worked on the Writers Project. And Arturo Campa at UNM helped coordinate all of this. And I think one of the amazing things is that because it was native-born writers who were cognizant of the importance of their culture, at times it must have been difficult. It must have been fascinating, and this sort of this early kind of, if you want to call it an activist movement or a recovery project of the history and the culture. But they also probably put themselves in difficult positions sometimes being the translators of that culture. But what they recouped and what they recorded is really extraordinary. And there hasn't been a mass project like that with so many people involved to recoup those stories again. Hasn't been done since. The whole body of work was an incredible recovery project.
3/4 of a century after its inception, the presence of the New Deal is still to be felt throughout our region and the rest of the United States. As Paul Horgan aptly pointed out earlier in this series, when our nation is in great crisis, be it economic, environmental, or spiritual, we require leadership at the highest levels of government, fired by enormous intellect and cosmic imagination. The Lore of the Land is sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Humanities Council. Funding is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities and the continued support of the Ford Foundation. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.